Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today we are incredibly lucky. We are joined by an incredible talent from the world of literary. They've been named New York's bestseller, over 40 million copies sold. They are hands down one of the world's best authors. And I know this is fact because they are indeed my favorite author. So much so that I got their book covers tattooed on me when traveling around Bangkok. I'm incredibly honored to be joined today by the wonderful Mr. Mitch Albom. Mitch, how are you?
I'm great. Is that true?
That's true. I was a little bit drunk, but I was thinking about it for a while.
I'm actually happy to hear that you were drunk. Doing that sober is disturbing.
Maybe silly. But they're quite cool, aren't they? The Ferris wheel, the hot air balloon. People say, why? And I say, I grew up by the seaside. We don't need to get into the deep and personal. But no, they're brilliant books, Mitch.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
Good stuff. Thank you. So I'll hit you with a big question to start, if that's okay. Sure. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Well, I'm a storyteller in terms of what I do. I'm a family person in terms of what matters to me. And the problems that I set out to solve, I'm not sure that I achieve it, is to try to bring a little hope to the people that I write for and to the children that I work with, which is kind of the other half of my life.
Good. And hope's a word that I'm sure will come up a couple of times in this conversation. So I've just finished reading your latest book, The Little Liar. Incredible as always. Your books typically come out around November time, and I look forward to them like a kid at Christmas. So you spoke about always, at the end of the book, you spoke about wanting to write a book about the Holocaust, but telling a story that hasn't been told before. So what inspired you to write The Little Liar?
Well, thank you for reading it, first of all. And, you know, you're right. I mean, there have been a lot of great books written about the Holocaust, and I didn't want to just duplicate those. I didn't want a book that began, you know, when the Jews are rounded up in some European city and ends with the liberation of a concentration camp, and in the middle is just dark and dour. I wanted to write a book about the truth. I thought that, you know, we've all heard about the things during the Holocaust that we paid a price for, but people don't often talk about the truth being one of the victims of that period of time. And the truth is that the Nazis did not achieve what they did because they had bigger guns. They did it because they had bigger lies. They were able to lie to their own people about, you know, what was going to bring them happiness and prosperity. They were able to lie about whose fault it was. And they were able to lie to their victims who, in many cases, disbelievingly, because they could not comprehend that someone could be that evil, literally walked to their deaths. And so I always had that in mind. And I had seen a story in a Holocaust museum on a visit about 10 years ago about a woman who was being interviewed. She was a survivor, and it was a video that they played on the wall. And the question they asked her was, why did you get on those trains that were going to the concentration camps if you knew that they were going to the concentration camps? Why would you willingly get on a train to your death? And she said, well, people don't understand that when we went to those train tracks, we were told that we were going someplace good. And in fact, the Germans would even force Jewish people to stand on the tracks and lie to us and tell us that we were going to new jobs, new homes. They would take our money and give us receipts and say, when you get there, you're going to get your money back. They gave us receipts for our bags. You know, when you get there, you'll get your bags back. I mean, think about the depth of the lying that went into trying to fool people so that you could kill them. And so I always kept that in mind as like a terrible example of perversion of the truth. And I was able to create a story that's a derivative of that. It's about a little boy who gets tricked into doing that lie. And I get to show the consequence of that lie, that one lie that he told on him and many people around him for 40 years. So the book kind of travels over 40 years time. So it's really a book, a parable about the truth and lying, with the Holocaust as a springboard for that parable.
Well, sticking on the topic of consequences there, I used to have a boss that used to say, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, which I think is quite a funny moral line. But the story you mentioned, it was narrated by Truth. So what is the impact of lies. So even the smallest ones, and what can they lead to in maybe some of your real life experiences as well?
Yeah. Well, that's really the question that, Jack, I wanted people to ask themselves when they read the book. What you just asked me, what's the biggest lie that you ever told in your life? What were the consequences of that lie? And lastly, what would you do to be forgiven that lie? You know, if you could get it back or undo the damage that was done. And I have witnessed lies ruin relationships. I've witnessed lies break up marriages. I've witnessed lies break up businesses, soil reputations, ruin people for no good reason. When a lie got on the wind, which is very easy to have happen now, you know, that old expression, a lie travels around the world before the truth gets to put its pants on in the morning. You know, that was said before social media. Mm-hmm. Imagine now when you can just pick a truth, pick a lie, put it up there. And if you have enough followers, the whole world knows about it before the person who you're lying about has a chance to defend themselves. So I think the timeliness of this book, given what we do with the truth in the world today, was one of the reasons I wanted to write it now. I had no idea that it would be timely in some other ways when I started writing it. But I think that whole idea of picking your truth and spreading it around the world is more true today than has ever been in history.
I was going to ask, because you talk about today and the modern times, has that story been sitting within you for a while, or is it only the last few years where you've felt like right now it's the right time to tell it?
I would say it's been sitting within me for a while. I'm one of these people, Jack, that has way more ideas for books than I have years left to write them. You know, I don't have writer's block. I thank God I don't suffer from that. I have so many ideas that I want to get down. And this has always been one of them. I always say that ever since Tuesdays with Maury, all of my books have contained a slice of Tuesdays with Maury in them. And if you look not too hard, you'll sort of see it. So like The Five People You Meet in Heaven was a parable, but it was really about, you know, how every life matters. There's no such thing as a nobody, something that Maury and I discussed while he was dying from, you know, motor neuron disease. Stranger in the Lifeboat was about, you know, what you choose to believe in and accepting help when it comes in front of you, even if it doesn't look like the help that you expected. Mm. Something that Maury and I talked about. And The Little Liar is largely about not just truth and lying, but about forgiveness and about being forgiven for something that, you know, maybe the worst thing that you ever did, something that he and I talked about a great deal before he died. And so that's sort of what guides me in picking the subjects that I'm going to talk about in my books. And this was one that was kind of percolating for a while.
I feel with all your books, Mitch, they've always got such deep themes that leave you with a question. And one of the ones that, one of my other favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning. And there's similar themes, obviously, because of the nature of the book around meaning and hope during even the most challenging times. So I guess when it comes to glass half full, glass half empty, why, from your point of view, why is hope so important even in the darkest times?
Well, it's a huge question, but a critical one. I think hope is oxygen for our souls. You know, we basically need it as much as we need oxygen to live. Maybe not to physically keep ourselves alive, but to mentally or emotionally be in life, you have to have hope. Viktor Frankl's book, brilliant book that you referenced, he said the only people who survived the concentration camps, of which he was one, were the people who believed that tomorrow could be better. And the people who gave up and said, this is hell, never made it. And I created a scene in the book directly as a result of that passage and rereading Viktor Frankl's book, when the family of this little boy ends up in the concentration camps. At night, the grandfather gathers the family together, the family members together in the barracks, and keeping their voice low so that the guards won't hear them, he insists that everybody say one good thing that happened to them that day. And of course, you know, what are you going to come up with in a concentration camp? What was the best thing that happened to you today in your concentration camp? So one of them says, well, I got an extra spoonful of soup today. And one says, I my rotted tooth fell out. One says, the guard who always beats me was off today. I didn't get beaten. One says, I saw a bird. you know, and that desire to find something positive, even in the most dire and deadly of circumstances, that desire to constantly find something good and hopeful is the essence of being human and is what propels us to go forward. So it's a critical lesson and something that's a huge part of the book.
And do you think, in order to build up resilience, do you think, what are some of the factors? Do you think hope is one of those key ingredients? And what else, what are the other factors included when it comes to building resilience?
Believe it or not, giving. The best antidote I have found to being resilient against the things that get thrown at you in life is finding someone who has it worse than you and giving of yourself to help make it better. And this is something I also learned alongside Maury. And I was 37 when I witnessed this, but I have never forgotten it. I watched him. He was dying, obviously couldn't move, needed to be carried from place to place. And people would come in and they would start to talk to him about, you know, trying to make him feel better, trying to give him some jokes or upbeat stuff. But very quickly, he would start asking them about their lives and then asking them about their other questions. And then they end up coming out of his office an hour later in tears, but they'd be crying about their job, their divorce, their love life. And they say, I don't know what happened. I went in to try to cheer him up. He started asking me questions. And next thing I know, I started really opening up and really opening up. And he ended up, you know, cheering me up. So I went to him. I said, I don't understand. You know, you're the one who's dying. Why don't you just accept the sympathy? You know, you've earned it. And he said, Mitch, why would I ever do that? That's just taking, and taking makes me feel like I'm dying, and giving makes me feel like I'm living. And it's a profound, tiny little sentence that is easy to remember because it rhymes, and it will come in so handy when you feel like, you know, you're just down and depressed and not resilient at all. You think about, well, let me go give something to somebody, and it's like caffeine for the soul. You know, it just picks you up. And I have this blessing of an orphanage that I operate since 2010 in Haiti, and I'm there every month. And I have to tell you, Jack, that, you know, while a lot of people who observe it from the outside will say, oh, isn't that great? You know, you go down, you give a week or 10 days a month to this orphanage, you operate all. It's totally the opposite. It's such a life-affirming, fulfilling thing for me, you know, to be able to come back and say, you know, these are kids who might not make it otherwise, and they're joyous and they're faithful and they're happy, and all their possessions could fit into a 12-inch by 12-inch box. And you see that and you take part in that and you realize, you know, your problems are only this big. And I find that to be the most resilient thing I can do in life.
And by giving them tiny pieces of you, it gives you meaning in a selfish world. It's one of those things.
Yeah. You get back great pieces of yourself. You give a little piece and it's like it gets taken, put in a blender, stirred around, puffed up, and then it comes back into you, and you somehow just feel better about yourself. And I know it sounds hokey, you know, but sometimes hokey's true, you know, and there's no other way to put it. You know, there's so many critics out there who just want to spit on the idea of hopefulness or positivity, and they just think, well, you can't be real if you're being positive. And I think, no, that's the kind of real you want to be. You know, I don't want to be real if everything is negative and everything is angst and all the characters are evil and everybody ends unhappy and life is Succession, you know, or some of the other shows where, you know, you finish watching them and you go, well, that was fantastic acting, and there wasn't a person in there that I would ever want to meet, you know,
of course.
Or, you know, I couldn't root for a single one of them. You know, that's not my version of storytelling anyhow.
And it may be hokey and having hope, but even if it isn't true, it's so useful. And that belief, like you say, it's the let's talk about the extra spoon of soup today. Well, whether it's true or not, it's useful. You got there first. I obviously couldn't have a conversation without talking about Tuesdays with Maury. It sold 80 million copies, which is phenomenal. It was released in 1997, so I was 5 years old. And it wasn't until 9 years later that it fell into my hands as a gift from my mum. And I started to have this deep curiosity as a teenager about life and death. So you've quoted Murray once already. I guess one of my favorites is, the truth is, once you learn how to die, you learn how to live.
That's right.
So I'm big on stoicism and memento mori. So without getting too philosophical, what's your journey been with facing mortality, and why is that so important?
Well, I believe that Mori was correct when he said that. And he gave an example. I think it comes from Buddhism where, you know, you keep a little bird on your shoulder every day and you say, is today the day I'm going to die? Every day you get up. And of course, every day of your life but one, the answer is going to be no. But one day the answer is going to be yes. And when that answer is yes, are you prepared for that answer to be yes? If you lead every day ready to be prepared, you know, trying to do everything and enjoy everything, whatever. So when the answer is yes, as well, all right, I've had a good life, then chances are you've led a fulfilling life. And that's what he meant by, you know, when you learn how to die, you learn how to live. When you learn how to really accept that that's what's out there. Because honestly, Jack, I think, I'm sorry about these interruptions here. I think what most people end up telling themselves about life and death is that, yes, I know I'm going to die eventually, unless they invent a pill just before I'm supposed to die and I'll be able to take that and I'll get another 50 years or something. There's that part of us that kind of thinks that that's going to happen. We don't really believe that we're going to die. And because Mori had no choice, you know, the evidence was too strong. He was looking at, you know, his age, his disease, and people just don't survive it. He had to turn and face it. And by turning and facing it, there was a calmness and an acceptance of like, okay, I'm not running away. I'm not avoiding anymore. I really realize this is here. Now let me turn with the time I have left and make the most of it and give out. And he chose to spend his time giving. You know, his idea of how to spend his final days wasn't, you know, put me on a plane and take me to Tahiti, take me to the highest mountain, take me to the places I haven't seen or do the adventures I haven't done. His idea was to spend as much time as he could with the people that he cared about in his life in meaningful ways. And I think there was a big lesson in that.
And before that period of your life, was there, what were your thoughts and feelings around your own mortality?
I gave not a whit thought to it. I mean, I was quite a different person back then. You know, I worked 80, 90 hours a week. I had 6 different jobs. Ambition was my goal and my sole kind of occupation, and anything else waited. So certainly, when you're being ambitious and climbing and trying to get ahead and all the rest of it, you're not thinking about dying. You know, you're just thinking about living forever. So it was quite a sea change for me. And it wasn't just sitting with Mori. That was the beginning of it. And that was really the base of it, if you will. But then I wrote the book to pay Mori's medical bills. And that was the only reason I wrote the book. I didn't know anything about writing a book like that. I was a sports writer. And I wrote the book to pay his bills. Nobody wanted it. We had to beg a publisher basically to take it. And when it came out, I thought, well, all right, I've done the nice thing. You know, I gave him the money. I gave his family the money to pay their bills. And now I'll go back to being a sports writer. And that's when the second part of Tuesdays with Mori took over, which was people started reading it like yourself. And suddenly every conversation that I had with strangers and with people I knew was about those themes, about life and death and about forgiveness and about relationships and all that. And you know, instead of talking about sports, my days were filled with talking about those kinds of things until it starts to seep into you when you start to become a person who is interested in those things and gravitates to those things. And it's the reason why I never wrote another sports book after that. I mean, all the 9 books that I've written since Tuesdays with Mori have all been like The Little Liar and other ones with exploring some of those ideas that Mori and I explored, you know, as he was dying.
And Mitch, they're brilliant because they have that spiritual element that leave you with a question and a thought and a feeling. So I guess it's been an absolute honor to have you, Mitch. I appreciate that you're a busy man. So thank you for taking the time out of your diary. I owe a big thank you. Obviously, I got your book covers tattooed whilst drunk, but those books, I think your books and It's a Wonderful Life have been a huge influence on my belief system and my morals and things like that. So I guess what stories have you got left to tell? What messages have you got left to spread, Mitch?
Well, there's lots of them. There's many, many things I'd like to explore. You know, I can't really sit down, Jack, and write a book just because I think I have a good idea for a character or a plot. I have a lot of author friends the room that's good enough. They get started and they say, I just let the characters take me where I'm going to go. And I admire that. I can't do it. For me, I have to have a lesson that I am either interested in learning or I've learned the hard way and want to pass on. And then I create a story around it. So, you know, in The Little Liar, with a little 11-year-old boy who's never told a lie in his life, and then the Nazis invade and they steal him from his family and they trick him into standing on those train tracks and telling people that it's safe to go and that they're going to new jobs and new homes. And he thinks he's doing the right thing and thinks he's telling the truth until the day he sees his family being shoved into a boxcar along with the little girl that he loves and finds out that the trains are going to the concentration camps. And then he's not allowed to go. And what happens to him as a result of that one lie and the 40 years that pass and how he seeks forgiveness and how the people who he harmed, you know, try to find him to tell him it wasn't his fault. And I think that comes from things that I've seen in my life and mistakes that I've made in my life, you know, and the kids that I see in Haiti. And so there, you know, that was one idea that blossomed into The Little Liar story. The next book I'm working on, for example, is about a person who gets to do everything twice in their life. You know, they get whatever they do, they get this magical opportunity to go back and fix it and do it again, except they have to live with the consequences of the second time. They can't say, I prefer the first time, I want to go back to that. And that deals with a theme that I've thought about many times in my life about, you know, would it be better if I had done, you know, the forks in the road that we would have taken. And you know, you've mentioned It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, that's a big kind of theme of that story, which I love, you know, about, well, here's what the world would have looked like if you weren't in it, or here's what, if you had taken, you know, the sliding doors theory, if you had just made it inside the train instead of missed that train, what would have all happened? So, you know, I've always wanted to explore that idea, and I have a kind of unusual premise for it. And then there'll be another one after that, another one after that. As long as my brain keeps wondering about things, and God gives me the health to be able to write, I'll be providing more tattoos for you, which is, I have to say, I've done a lot of interviews in my life. That is the first time I've ever heard someone say to me, I have your book covers tattooed somewhere. I'm not seeing them. I don't want to know.
I'm not going to get my legs out now. I'll send you a photo afterwards.
Picture. Well, I'm very flattered by that. And I'll tell the art designer of the covers, who's always the same person, that somewhere his work is on flesh as well as canvas.
Permanently inked. Mitch, thank you so much. If anybody has been listening to this and they're curious to find out more about Mitch, please go to all good bookstores, go to online retailers, buy a copy of The Little Liar. It's an amazing book. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug before I let you go, Mitch?
Oh, not so much plug, but if people are interested in our work in Haiti, and the children that were there, I'm there every month. And as I say, and we have some amazing, amazing groups of kids that, 60, 65 kids in any given time who are thriving there with love and food and little else in a very, very dangerous and extraordinarily poor country. And, I'm very proud of what they've been able to do. We have 12 of them in college now and one of them in medical school, and, they're worth learning about. So they could go to havefaithhaiti.org and find out about what happens down there at the orphanage. So I appreciate you letting me share that with your audience.
Incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time today, Mitch.
Sure, Jack. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.